This time, the Columbia Broadcasting System presents news analyst H.V. Kaltenborn with a review of today's news developments at home and abroad. Mr. Kaltenborn.
Good evening, everybody. The first thing that occurred to me when I heard the news of the seizure of the steamship City of Flint is that the Germans were taking her in order to be able to question the crew concerning the sinking of the Athenia. You remember that the City of Flint picked up the survivors of that ill-fated vessel. And I wondered why the Germans should have captured an American ship at this particular time, a ship which was not carrying munitions, a ship which was carrying a cargo which was largely non-contraband or conditional contraband, and a ship which was distinctly American, the first American ship which the Germans had seized. And then that possible explanation occurred to me. And tonight, I note there's a dispatch from Amsterdam that neutral diplomatic quarters advance the same theory, that the City of Flint was seized in order to obtain testimony of the City of Flint crew regarding the Athenia disaster. You've got to remember that the Germans have made a cause célèbre of that sinking. They have insisted that the British sank the Athenia and have vigorously denied that any German submarine had anything to do with it. And there has been some contradictory testimony as to just how she was sunk, and the Germans have taken every possible advantage of that. So these neutral quarters in Amsterdam point out that it's rather strange that the City of Flint should have been seized only to have the vessel and its cargo turned over for internment in Russia. That would certainly seem to be a waste of time for a German warship. And then, of course, it was considered a blunder in international relations if the Germans are really anxious, as they definitely seem to be, and Ribbentrop's speech today confirms that, anxious to preserve American good opinion. They've certainly made every possible propaganda effort to preserve it, and coming just at the time when the Senate is about to vote on the embargo, lifting it or retaining it, it certainly wasn't good diplomacy for the Germans to seize that ship at this particular time. Now, Secretary of State Hull today, in discussing the seizure, indicated that the United States would firmly insist upon its neutral rights, but his comment was in no sense belligerent. After all, there is a good deal of justification for belligerents to seize vessels that carry what they believe to be contraband. Britain is doing it all the time. Britain has several American ships in her control now that are being searched with the idea of possibly discovering contraband. Well, they may not find any, and the vessels will have lost several weeks in a British port, which is quite an expensive procedure for the owners of the vessels, and yet there's no compensation. That's the sort of thing that happens in war. And, of course, because it happens and because of the difficulties that result from these seizures, that's one reason for the cash and carry provision in the Neutrality Act. We hope to avoid the difficulties that are inherent in that sort of thing. United States Ambassador Steinhardt made a report from Moscow today on the seizure of the City of Flint, but had absolutely no information to give, and there is no information as to just what has become of the American crew. You remember that the liner was seized by a German raider en route to England and was taken to a Norwegian and then later to a Russian port by a German prize crew. And it's interesting that on the basis of the information that we have here as to what the cargo of the City of Flint contained, Mr. Hull, at his press conference today, indicated that he thought that perhaps half of the cargo was conditional contraband. Well, under international law, if 50% or more of a cargo is any kind of contraband, the belligerent has a right to seize the vessel. That's the belligerent's right under international law. Now, of course, the United States is not obliged to accept either the German or the British definition of contraband. But if we disagree, what are we going to do about it? There's the point. When belligerents act in time of war, they're usually so determined to have their way that unless you're ready to fight them, you're not going to make much progress. You certainly can't get anywhere by sweet persuasion. We found that out in the World War. So unless we're prepared to fight for all our rights under the doctrine of the freedom of the seas, what we must do is to restrict the operation of our vessels. Now, that's exactly what we're proposing to do under the Neutrality Act. We're not going to insist on unlimited freedom of the seas for the American merchant marine. We're going to restrict the operations of our vessels in such ways as seem most conducive to the American purpose of keeping out of this war. 3 weeks of speeches in the United States Senate on the Neutrality Act, which don't seem to have changed many votes, were followed today by high-speed action. Those who oppose lifting the embargo agreed today to a definite limitation of Senate debate. Hereafter, each senator is only going to be permitted to speak 45 minutes on the bill itself, and then 45 minutes on each amendment. Now, of course, if every senator wanted to speak an hour and a half on the bill and on each amendment, why, that in itself would entail a great deal of time. But that isn't the purpose. The idea is to give certain senators who don't want to be completely cut off from the right of discussing amendments in particular, to give them the opportunity of speaking. And there is every prospect, according to what the leaders told the president today, that the vote on the bill will come by the end of this week. A number of controversial amendments have been put forward by the isolationist bloc. And while Vice President Garner seemed to be ready to vote on the bill today, the isolationist bloc, members of it, objected and asked for time to discuss their proposed amendments, and that seems fair enough. However, with practically without debate, the Senate today adopted amendments which will permit United States ships to continue trade with belligerent ports in South America, in the Far East, in Bermuda, and in parts of Canada. Some of the votes are interesting. The Senate upheld by a vote of 71 to 18 a provision to give the President the power to decide which neutral European ports will be open to United States ships. You remember there's been quite a debate about these belligerent zones, and now the final decision is that the President is in the best position to decide which neutral ports are safe at any particular time. Ports of Germany, France, and Britain are to be unconditionally barred to United States vessels. Republican Senator Taft asked for the declaration of a danger zone around all Europe, but that was rejected by the Senate. Then the Senate rejected by 62 votes to 24 a proposal that was made by Republican Senator Danaher of Connecticut to limit the export of airplanes. He said that these planes are needed for the defense of the United States. Well, of course, the obvious answer to his argument that has been made by airplane manufacturers in this country is that the more planes we manufacture for sale abroad, the better we'll be able to make planes for ourselves, and the more we learn about the kind of planes that are the best. After all, the airplane industry is still in its infancy. Practically every new plane that is made has certain improvements over the old ones, and if the United States can now manufacture planes on a much larger scale than we've manufactured them before, and remember that we're making only about one-tenth, perhaps only one-twentieth of as many as certain European countries. In other words, they're way ahead of us on large-scale manufacture of planes. It would seem that the opportunity to develop our plants, to try out new models, to develop new models, to develop machinery for the large-scale manufacture of planes, that in itself would be a considerable contribution to American defense. And as a matter of fact, that argument has been made by various United States senators. There was a little passage at arms between Vice President Garner and Senator Clark of Missouri. Senator Clark at one time charged that the Vice President was trying to railroad the bill through the Senate. And the Vice President replied, "There will be no railroading, but we won't stand for horse and buggy procedure either," which reminded the members of the Senate that on the Supreme Court battle, the Vice President was not driving the administration's chariot into high speed. There's an interesting dispatch from Berlin that tells us that Nazi elite guards were working today with sponges and mops to remove a gigantic sign scrawled across the wall of a suburban villa occupied by German Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, and the sign read, Slave to Stalin. Now, that's significant of two things, assuming that it's true. First, the unpopularity of Ribbentrop, and secondly, the unpopularity of the Russian alliance. It would be my guess that Nazis did that. I doubt that in well-regulated, well-controlled Germany, anyone who was not a member of the party would dare to attempt such an enterprise. And that happens on the very day on which German Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop speaks in Danzig to tell the world that Hitler is not going to make any more peace offers. There was no peace lead in the von Ribbentrop speech. The basis of it was largely an attack on Britain. Britain has worked systematically towards war against Germany since the Munich Conference, said Herr von Ribbentrop. Of course, on the basis of my talks with the men who were directing the political policy of Britain and France in Europe a few weeks ago, it would have been more true to say that the British government gave up the hope of peace after Hitler broke what they thought was his promise by entering Prague, by seizing Bohemia and Moravia. It was not Munich. Munich was hailed by Chamberlain as a triumph of peace. It was the German entry into Prague that completely changed both British and French policy. And then Ribbentrop went on and said that there is not a single doubt that the entire world public opinion indicates that the French people did not want this war. But of course the same thing could be said of the British people and of the German people. I found no one, either in Germany or in Britain, that wanted the war. Among the people hoped devoutly, sincerely, that war could be avoided. That, of course, was Ribbentrop's attempt to appeal to France in contrast with Britain. Von Ribbentrop also said that Britain had reached an agreement with Germany at Munich last year only because British armaments were not ready for a war. That was one reason. Yes, the leaders of Britain admitted that. So did the leaders of France. That they, one reason why they agreed to Munich was because they were not ready for war. But the love of peace was certainly another reason, and an unjustified trust in Hitler were other reasons. Germany has accepted the British challenge, said Mr. Ribbentrop, and the German people are determined not to lay down arms before the security of the German Reich in Europe is guaranteed, and until there is a certainty that Germany will not be attacked. Well, have Britain and France really menaced the security of the Reich? Certainly not its territorial integrity. Germany is anxious, says Mr. Ribbentrop, for good relations with the United States. There is no possible difference between Germany and the United States. Germany has always respected the Monroe Doctrine. She has no interests to represent in the Western Hemisphere except an interest in building up trade. So speaks Ribbentrop. But some of us remember that Zimmermann note of not so many years ago, which did indicate a very definite, different kind of interest. Good night.
You have just been listening to H.B. Kaltenborn, Columbia's news analyst, give you his review of today's news developments at home and abroad.